Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Is the world more peaceful since the revolution? It is a shame that your people suffered. But bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
Hello and welcome to the penultimate episode of Still Watching The Mandalorian. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I am Anthony Bresnikan, a special correspondent at Vanity Fair.
And we are here to talk about Chapter 7, The Reckoning.
The Reckoning. That sounds very apocalyptic.
Directed by Deborah Chow, written by Jon Favreau. This is one of my favorite episodes of The Mandalorian. Are you excited?
I'm excited, and it made me even more excited for the Obi-Wan series because
yes,
Deborah Chow did such a great job with, I guess it was episode 3, right? And then, and now episode 7. And I think really showed those are two very different types of stories structurally. And I think, I'm definitely even more enthusiastic for what she's going to do with that new series. But this was a great episode.
Yeah, this, we'll get into some of the deeper stuff of this episode, because I think this episode really addresses some of the criticisms that had been sort of building in me in the middle stretch of Mandalorian. This episode really hit some of those, which is great. But I remember when I was watching episode 3, I thought it was really cool that they give like the big shootout episode, because that's the episode that ends with like all the Mandalorians coming out and the big, you know, jetpack fight. I thought it was really cool that they gave, you know, their female director this big sort of action heavy episode to direct, because oftentimes like female directors are relegated to more emotional episodes or that sort of thing. And then in this episode too, it has a lot of great action. There's that great, like, I'm going to call it the pterodactyl attack. And once again, I was like, they let Deb Chow do this too? Like,
monster attack, nighttime monster raid. Yeah.
You know, she did a great job.
She absolutely did. And, you know, going back to our previous episode when, we interviewed her, she talked about her dad, like her dad's influence on chapter 3. Yeah, dad was a big Hong Kong movie fan. And I think, you know, we sometimes assume, as you said, oh, well, the female director is there for the touchy-feely, the sweetheart Baby Yoda stuff. But she developed a love of, like, insane Hong Kong action and martial arts fighting and wild gun fights from her dad's love of action movies. And, you know, good for her because she's, she said it was very important that she just be seen as a director. And respect that, not as a female director, not as a Asian American director, but she also said, you know, it is important. This is her career and other people's careers too. So if she can break down a gate and let some other people in or show that all sorts of people can tell these stories, then that's like a bonus and also pretty wonderful.
I'm just reminded of what, you know, because this is something that Star Wars as a franchise has been grappling with, you know, like Deborah Chow and Bryce Dallas Howard both worked on The Mandalorian, but, you know, there still has yet to be a woman directing a feature film of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And when a lot of that debate was first starting to kick up a couple of years ago about, like, female directors and Star Wars, one, I can't remember who said it, it was just super tone deaf, and I don't think it was from a person that I like generally think is tone deaf. It was a real tone deaf comment, but it was something like, well, I just don't think women are interested in directing those kinds of movies. And I was just like, oh my God, what are you talking about? So, it's nice to see Deb Chow just swoop in and really like say, no, you know what? And Bryce Dallas Howard too. There's great action in Bryce's episode too, but like that, you know what? Like, yes, guess what? Women are humans and humans have all kinds of different interests. So here we are, you know? Yeah, I found the quote just to make sure that I'm accurately quoting this person. It was former Star Wars director, once and former Star Wars director Colin Trevorrow himself, who said, I want to believe that a filmmaker with both a desire and ability to make a studio blockbuster will be given an opportunity to make their case. He tweeted this. I stress desire because I honestly think that's part of the issue. Many of the top female directors in our industry are not interested in doing a piece of studio business for its own sake. These filmmakers have clear voices and stories to tell that don't necessarily involve superheroes or spaceships or dinosaurs.
Well, I guess I just stepped in it then because
I don't think you were quite saying what he was saying. And I think, like, once again, I think what Trevorrow was dealing with there was like he had been hired to direct episode 9 and a lot of people were like, jeepers, what is it going to take to get a woman to direct a Star Wars movie? And he was feeling like that was personally sort of like his fault. And then, of course, he wound up not even getting to direct that movie. So, you know, it's all water under the bridge at this point anyway.
I guess I want to, as an addendum.
Yeah.
That's what I had said before was, and I do think it's sort of parallels what he just said there, what he said a number of years ago. But that was one of the theories out there. But I think a theory disproven by the fact that there are lots of women who want to direct Star Wars, and they are doing it now. Excuse me. So I think that theory has really kind of fallen apart.
Yeah, and thanks to great stuff like this. So great episode. The thing that this episode, you know, we'll get into some specifics, but overall, the reason why this episode works so well for me is that I think, though I've been enjoying the like the adventure of the week format of The Mandalorian, the fact that this episode draws back in these characters from the other series and some of the most successful characters. Like, I love bringing back Nick Nolte's character, Kweel, and I love seeing Cara Dune back, and I love, you know, seeing Greef Karga and the client. Like, they're all back, and so then we already know who they are. We already care who they are. Kweel is like, when it was clear that Kweel was going to show up again, I was like, oh God, you know what? I kind of think he's my favorite character. And then by the end of the episode, I was like, oh, thanks, The Mandalorian. But you know what I mean? Like he had
spoken.
That serialized quality allows for a more impact. Like the adventure last week was really fun. The sort of like heist adventure. But the male Twi'lek character dies, you're not feeling anything about it because you've just met him. You know what I mean? Whereas when Kweel goes down, or even the client, even though the client's a bad guy, you feel that loss because you're like, Werner Herzog, I was invested in your appearance in the show sort of thing. So
I was invested in the cadence of the way you deliver all of your lines.
All right. So for the Star Wars ignorant among us, Anthony Bresnikan, can you run down for me? I think we get at least three different kinds of troopers in this episode. Can you run down for me what the three troopers we see in this episode are?
Well, we see the traditional beaten up original trilogy trooper.
Right. Stormtrooper. Yes.
Stormtroopers. We get scout troopers.
Yeah.
Who turned up in Return of the Jedi. They're kind of speeder bike operators, like biker troopers in a way.
Yeah.
and then we get Christmas troopers.
They're death troopers, right?
Death troopers, yeah. I'm just joking. Christmas That's what I keep thinking whenever I see the red Sith troopers. I'm like, how festive. Life Day.
I always think of they always look like the bottom of a Louboutin shoe, right?
The Sith troopers?
The red Sith troopers. Yeah. So Death Troopers
who turned up in Rogue One. As sort of like the special forces of Director Krennic.
So one little fun fact about the scout troopers, and I love the scout troopers. I just like love their little helmets. I love the little like boxy thing on the scout trooper helmet. But our comedian cameo of the week this week is Happy Endings alum Adam Pally is voicing one of the scout troopers.
Yeah.
So that's our little cameo this week. This isn't a very cameo heavy episode. So I think that's
no. And do we think he was even in that suit?
I mean he did a voiceover. Good job, Adam Pally.
Send it in. Yeah, I'm sure it was great.
It's still fun to you know, recognize the voice. So, okay. So those are our troopers that we get. And then we get this new character, Moff Gideon, played by Giancarlo Esposito, who a lot of people know from Breaking Bad, but obviously has a long and storied career. I love when Giancarlo, speaking of Christmas movies, I love it when Giancarlo Esposito shows up in like a cameo in Trading Places, the Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd movie, and he's like impossibly young and you're like, oh, Giancarlo, hello. That was an unnecessary aside. I apologize. But so he shows up as like the big bad of the season. We see the client go down and you're like, oh, I thought Werner Herzog was as big and as bad as it got. But here's Moff Gideon clearly much more in charge. And he does the classic bad guy move that I think Krennic, Kylo Ren, and Vader really made, which is the departure from the Imperial ship. You know, like, I'm just going to land my ship right here. Boom, here I am. I'm scary. My outfit's fabulous. Here I am. What did you think of the introduction of Moff Gideon here?
Very Gus Fring. But it was interesting because you talk about seeing young Giancarlo Esposito and what was it? In Trading Places?
Yeah, Trading Places.
Yeah. I just saw him again in one of my favorite scenes, the sequence where he confronts Danny Aiello in Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
Spike Lee's film from 1989. So again, like, geez, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
He looks so different. Like, he has changed so much and he hasn't like gained or lost weight. It's just, there's something about his face that has aged, but developed menace. And he always was like, he always played characters who had a sort of like a crackling edge to them. Like, character in Do the Right Thing is bugging out and he's the one who's kind of enjoying his pizza and he looks up at the wall and he sees like Frank Sinatra, old blue eyes, and you know, who else is on there? Dean Martin. And he's like, hey Sal, how come there's no brothers on the wall? and Sal, played by Danny Aiello. And the reason I'm watching this, of course, is because Danny Aiello just died.
Just passed,
Sal gets in his face and is like, you know, it's my pizzeria. I put Italian-Americans on the wall only. And the idea is, well, you know, it's most of your clientele is black. So shouldn't we be represented there? And I think it's like a brilliant scene. And that movie should have won Best Picture in 89. But like, it's brilliant because, holy cow, we're still having this conversation. Like, how come there are no, or so few female, directors, so few, women of color directing, how come there are no brothers on the wall is a question that could stand, for a lot of different things that we're having discussions about right now in pop culture and who has creative control.
Yeah.
So anyway, a little aside, absolutely. a little Giancarlo, Esposito aside, but like, interestingly, he, as a young man, he used to play characters who had that, disruptive quality about them, but also were powerless. and now he has this, like, he has, now that he's an older man, he has this intensity and gravitas where you're like, well, maybe he does have power. Like, that dude is scary. He is very scary. And he's not even like growling or snarling or overplaying it as Moff Gideon. He's just laying out the facts. And that's the cliffhanger, is just Giancarlo Esposito telling it like it is. You have something I want. You don't understand it. I'm coming to get it. Like, oh my God, he is, you know, he's going to storm into that cantina and be like, you know, I'm going to put Baby Yoda on the wall. There you go.
Yeah, it's interesting because I did want to mention, well, yeah. In terms of Giancarlo Esposito and his particular brand of menace, like, especially as Gus Fring, it was a lot of stillness. And actually with Gus Fring, geniality, which was creepier than any kind of like snarling, yelling, was like Gus Fring smiling and you're so creeped out. But in this, we only get a little bit of him. It's like a tease for the finale. But, one thing that we did want to talk about is this idea of casting Giancarlo Esposito, who is a non-white man, as this sort of like, ex-imperial, maybe proto First Order figure here. Because, you know, at least in live action, I know there's an exception in the animated series, but, at least in live action, these bad guys are usually white and they're usually British. Werner Herzog, obviously not British, but, you know, usually it's white British guys. And that's sort of, you know, obviously Darth Vader is voiced by James Earl Jones, but like that's been like sort of the thing of the Empire and the First Order are these like fascistic, white supremacist, you know, goose-stepping sort of illusions that's part of their whole thing. Yeah. And so to have a non-white man in that role, I think, is interesting. What do you think of that choice there?
Yeah, I mean, they're literally called stormtroopers, and that's straight out of Nazi Germany. And you look at the way that they've been constructed, even their colors and their symbols are very fascist. And I remember when The Force Awakens came out and there was a lot of questions about who is this first character we see, this black man played by John Boyega in a stormtrooper suit. Like, who is this guy? Before we [S2] Right. [S1] Knew a name, before we knew a background, he's in a stormtrooper suit, but that doesn't add up. Like, people were puzzled by that. And I think one of the reasons they're puzzled is, well, one, they think, you know, I think there was an assumption at that point that all stormtroopers were clones, which of course we learned is not the case, at least not, a couple generations later. But, the idea that, we're so used to them feeling like space Nazis. And as you and I were joking before, we began recording, you know, fascists have a long way to go toward diversifying. I think they really got to work on their representation, but it's, you don't expect to see that. But of course, in the novels, and I think in some of the animated storytelling, for sure, you do see people of color as Imperials, and they, whatever their other hateful flaws, they apparently are not intending to be like a white supremacy organization. So it's, it's interesting to see him in this role. And as you say, first time it's happened in live action Star Wars storytelling.
Yeah. So here he is. He's dressed in like almost all black. So you know he means business. I think one way
he was kind of armored too. Like he has, looks like partial battle armor. Like he might, I can picture that dude putting on a helmet and picking up a blaster and charging into the fray, you know?
I think that, the best way to like, you know, quickly show us how scary someone is to have them just like dispassionately dispatch Werner Herzog. You're like, whoa, okay. Wow.
And when he was warming up too, like he was just sort of chilling out. The client had, I think my favorite line of the episode, you know, and, it's a little bit silly, I suppose, but when he goes, "Can I offer you a libation to celebrate the close of our shared narrative?" I'm like, oh, that's how I'm going to say goodbye to everybody at New Year's Eve this year. Let's close out our shared narrative.
He also speaks for all of us when he goes, I want to see the baby. We're all like, yes, I do.
I was waiting for like the client to like start cooing or be like, who is a baby Yoda?
All right. So let us circle back to a few other things before that happened before Moff Gideon shows up. First of all, let's talk about baby Yoda and the Force. Obviously we talked, last week about like, oh, maybe baby Yoda doesn't have his Force powers anymore. And this week they're like, he definitely does. That was an incorrect question, that we asked. But we see two sort of, instances here. We see the, interference with the arm wrestling competition and then later the Force healing, which is sort of a payoff of something that we saw earlier, him try to do to the Mandalorian earlier in the season. So let's talk about the choke before we talk about the healing, which is the first time, Force healing has ever been used, right? In something that audiences have seen at this point.
At this point, yes.
Yep. and
let's have no more discussion about this bizarre mystery.
but in terms of the Force choking, you raised an interesting question in your write up on Vanity Fair this morning, which is why would Baby Yoda intervene on this arm wrestling and choke out Cara Dune, sip on some bone broth when they're having a full on the ground brawl in an earlier episode. You posited some theories around that. Do you think that there are legitimate reasons for that, or is this like just a sort of plot, a minor plot hole situation?
I don't know if it's a if it's a plot hole. I think there are two possibilities here. One, that it has an actual explanation that in over the past 7 episodes, Baby Yoda's seen a lot of stuff. Like, Baby Yoda's seen some violence and been threatened and been saved. And so, you know, that little bone broth scene was chapter 4, right? It was the Bryce Dallas Howard episode. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that comes right after the escape from the clutches of the Empire on Navarro. So, Baby Yoda was still a little like, what are these humans doing? But then, you know, you go through the battle there, where they save the villagers. Then there's some violence on the ship, during the heist. What was the other one? I'm missing one here. So chapter 4 and then chapter 5 was the, which episode?
Okay, so we've got chapter 4, Sanctuary, which is the bone broth episode, as I will now forever call it, the bone broth episode. Chapter 5, the gunslinger, is where
they go to
young hotshot, mm-hmm. right, sort of thing. And then chapter 6, the prisoner, is the heist.
So that's 3 episodes of ultraviolence that Baby Yoda's seen, and that maybe Baby Yoda's like fed up with it. Like, Baby Yoda recognized the Mudhorn was going to trash and destroy the Mandalorian and lift, you know, made it fly through the air with the greatest of ease. And in this point, he sees them kind of just doing an arm wrestling thing and then just Force chokes Cara Dune, and she is freaked. Now, so maybe Baby Yoda is just paying more attention than we're aware, that he isn't just oblivious, sort of baby's day out, bumbling around, you know, Mr. Magoo style.
But, I mean, yeah, and also, like, when he does it, it's not just like, oh no, my human is in trouble, I need, or my Mandalorian is in trouble, I need to protect him. He's like, he looks a little evil when he does it, to be honest with you.
It's a little heavy. I mean, we used to have this cat named Sinatra, and we'd have people come over, and, you know, Sinatra was like a sweetheart to me and my wife, but like, he would just scratch other people, and everybody thought he was this mean cat. And it's like, he's so sweet, but then every now and then your cat bites the visitor to your house. And I think that's, maybe what's happening here. But my second theory on this is that Baby Yoda has a little bit of baby Clark Kent going on. Mm. And, you know, the joke with baby Clark Kent is like, he cries and wants a bottle and like burns a hole in the ceiling, or he has a tantrum and smashes open his crib. Is that Baby Yoda in this episode is established as somebody, and this is what I made my headline for the Vanity Fair recap, is somebody, he can hurt you, you know? And we see that in a couple of different ways, not just the force choke, but then Baby Yoda gets into the cockpit and like almost crashes the ship.
Yeah.
So like Baby Yoda is not just this cute, cuddly little green, you know, Puddin' Pop, but is, this, this, he's also like, he's got a little bit of the, that kid from the Twilight Zone. I forget the name of the episode, but I remember his name was Anthony. Obviously.
Oh, of course.
Do you remember this episode where the kid has like basically godlike powers? And so everybody in his family is just trying to placate him at all times and fearing his wrath. And the Baby Yoda's got a little bit of that. Like he's strong and he's not 100%, reasonable. So there could be real damage done by this kid losing his temper or, you know, just making mischief. So I think we got a little sense of Baby Yoda's danger, his bad boy. We got bad boy Baby Yoda.
Bad boy Baby Yoda. So we got this email from, you know, speaking of that near ship crash, we got this email from a listener, Chris, back for episode 5, The Gunslinger. But Chris writes, the Mandalorian makes some questionable decisions in episode 5. He leaves Baby Yoda unattended twice, even though he's highly protective of him. He doesn't even take a moment to ask the Amy Sedaris character to look out for Baby Yoda before he takes off. And I like that Cara Dune is like, we need a babysitter. Like, what are you doing? We're about to go do this thing and we don't have a babysitter. And he's like, oh, it just struck me as very like, I don't know, single dad or whatever it is, like, the kid can braid its own hair before it goes to school, right? And you're like, no, single
very
dad.
Very paper moon. Very paper moon.
Gotta have a babysitter if you're gonna go off gallivanting and just sort of, like, that's what he's been doing. He's just like, I'm gonna lock you in the closet and that's fine, right? I won't even crack a like window.
He doesn't treat him like a baby. He treats him like a cat. Like, I'm just gonna leave the cat aboard the ship. Yeah. And I think, this is an episode, and I don't think that's a plot hole. Like, I think in some ways it's a plot necessity. Like, you can't go gunslinging and have Baby Yoda, like, all the time.
Right.
You gotta put him aside. You gotta put Baby in the corner. Like, there's a, like, so there's a plot reason for that. But then in this episode, they kind of rationalize it because Mandalorian gets, like, awesome parenting advice from Quill.
Yeah.
In the context of Quill raising IG-11 to be his son, butler?
I love this part. So I promise we're going to come back to the force healing, probably. Yes, we will. But yes, this is my favorite part of the episode. And I think this is where the episode has real depth to it in a way that I think some of the other episodes didn't feel like they had depth to them. And I've been talking a lot, you know, you and I have seen The Rise of Skywalker. You and I will be talking about The Rise of Skywalker on another Vanity Fair podcast, Little Gold Men. So if you're listening to this and you're like, why aren't they talking about Rise of Skywalker? Yes, we have seen it. Yes, we will talk about it, but you have to go listen to another podcast to hear us do it. But something that I've been talking to people this week about is sort of like, what do you want from a Star Wars movie? And do you want just action adventure, or do you want some like deeper sort of soulful rumination on the nature of humanity or spirituality or existence or morality? And I want both. Like, why not both, right? Mm-hmm. And I think when Star Wars is at its best, it does both, right? And I think what we've been getting is a lot of the adventure without the soul. And I think in this episode where we see this conversation about like what make, you know, he Quill is basically like, a droid isn't good or bad. A droid is like what you raise it to be. And we see Baby Yoda force choke and force heal. So it's like, Baby Yoda isn't good or bad. Baby Yoda is what you raise him to be. You know,
well, that adds credence to the notion that Baby Yoda is doing what is imitating what he's seen, which kids definitely do.
Yeah, absolutely. And just sort of like, this idea, but like, you know, you are far more Star Wars fluent than I am. What is your interpretation of like, you know, because we've got all these force users in Star Wars over the years. And there's the dark side and the light, and there's this idea of like falling to the dark side or being seduced by the dark side. But what is your sense of what the franchise has tried to say about like, are there people who are inherently light side users and inherently dark side users, or is it always a matter of choice or how you're raised or how you're nurtured?
I think it's nurture and experience with a little bit of how you're wired. You know, Anakin Skywalker, if he didn't have phenomenal cosmic powers, would not be such a threat. He'd just be, you know, some jerk moisture farmer. But I think that it's the idea that inherent in every being is potential. And that potential is given direction based on either the kindness or the cruelty that that kid faces. And with Anakin, you could say, well, he was nurtured by, you know, he had this slave mom who was badly mistreated, and he saw a lot of suffering as like a little kid, but then he was taken in by the Jedi. Yeah, taken in basically as like a child soldier. And so maybe that was the mistake of the Jedi, is their whole thing was, oh yeah, he's even too old now, right? And he's still just a little kid. Well, like actually, maybe the Jedi training should have come later, like at the age of, you know, what we would consider in our universe to be like, you graduated from high school and now you're going to go off to your career. You know, like Rey's age, essentially, or Finn's age, that maybe that's when you begin training people in the ways of the Force, when they have the maturity and they've made the mistakes of youth, have learned from them and had the opportunity to be shown both cruelty and kindness. So I always felt like that's the evolving message of Star Wars. And I think, I know we're not going to get into The Rise of Skywalker here, but I think it's reflected in that movie too. Where you have a character like Rey who has seen both and knows which way she wants to gravitate.
That push and pull of the dark side, light side, and this idea of like, we've talked about this before, bad dads of Star Wars. You and I have talked off air about the bad dads of Star Wars and stuff like that. It's usually dead moms and bad dads, unfortunately. The moms don't get a chance to be bad moms, but sort of the inherited trauma that comes from that. And the great that if you are incredibly powerful, you are increasingly susceptible to the seductions of the dark side. That's definitely a thing that goes hand in hand. But I really love the messaging of this episode. And the time it takes, you know, this episode, like last week's, is a little longer, and the time it has for this IG-11 montage, which is lovely to watch the patience of Kuiil as he just sort of like slowly rehabilitates this droid. It's both funny and I genuinely think touching, you know?
I'm just thinking of when IG-11 drops the container on the lizard and then by the end of the montage sees the lizard, you know, and I think that's a joke, is that the lizard doesn't get squashed the second time, but also I think that's really beautiful and done in a super subtle way. You know, like we have these phrases, jump the shark. I think see the lizard is not necessarily bumper sticker quality or something you're going to see on a t-shirt at Star Wars Celebration, but see the lizard is actually very meaningful. It's just because you can destroy something and you think it has no meaning and no significance doesn't mean you should. You should make your choices deliberately if you're going to act in a way that's destructive. Do it with purpose. I mean, for good. You know what I mean? If you have to fight, fight. But don't just stomp all over things. And see, the lizard is a nice little... It's not spoken in the movie, but I have spoken. And I think it's a nice little gesture between this Ugnaught, who is a free man, like a freed slave. Indentured servitude was how he described himself as a member of the... Imperial army or imperial services, and that he spent it that way for three human lifetimes before earning his way out. And I think a character like that, who has been overwhelmingly exposed to cruelty, still somehow recognizes that it's wrong and doesn't express it himself or doesn't perpetuate it himself. So see the lizard. I think that's a nice little theme.
Well, yeah, and he also, you know, via these conversations with Kara, who is like, immediately wants to write him off because he's ex-Imperial.
Right.
Like we see how quickly she agrees to this job when she finds out that the client is ex-Imperial. You know, she's like, no, he's ex-Imperial, I'm in, you know, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then she meets Kuiil and she's like, she's like, this guy, I mean, why are we trusting him? He's ex-imperial. And you know, Kuiil is very like, dignified in his sort of like, I'm proud of how I worked my way out of there. And like, I didn't have a choice and I did the best I could and all this sort of stuff. And so this idea of like, don't write me off because of like this thing that happened. Like, and Kuiil is just like the coolest, nicest person we've met on the show. And also like the wisdom and the slow training and all that, like it feels very like he is the Yoda figure of the season, right? Like, versus, you know, we've got a baby Yoda, but that thing is, you know, choking people. It doesn't know what it's doing.
It doesn't have wisdom. That's what's missing. Yeah. It's not a wise creature.
Right. But Kuiil is wise. And so, yeah, I'm so happy he's back. You know, he seemed apparently dead in the end, but like, you know, IG-11's back. He was smoking a little, but we don't know that he's dead, so we'll see.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
The IG-11 thing, so that's the other thing, right, is like the Mandalorian has had this prejudice towards droids throughout the whole thing. And Kuiil is trying to like sort of, which we saw really, really pointed out and underlined and highlighted in last week's episode. And so Kuiil is like, no, you got to give him a chance. And I think we're setting up IG-11 to do something incredibly heroic that the Mandalorian has to like reconsider his values in the finale. Cause Kuiil says very pointedly, he doesn't attack anymore, but he can like protect.
He can protect. Yeah.
Right. So like, it's possible that like baby Yoda won't even make it back to Moff Gideon if IG-11 like pops out of the ship and protects him somehow from those scout troopers. You don't know. We don't know, but like, that's a possibility. But I feel like the IG-11 is going to get to do something heroic that's going to bookend him trying to kill the child in the first episode. Right. Possibly. All right. So let's get back to this force healing thing. I want to say quickly before we go there, I really love that Greef Karga is like, oh, we'll make bed by the riverbank. And then we'll go in. And I was like, oh, does this planet have both lava and a riverbank? Two ecosystems? And I was like, oh, no, it's a lava river.
Lava okay. river.
Still only one ecosystem.
The floor is lava.
The lava riverbank. Okay, so Greef Karga gets mauled by this pterodactyl thing. And Baby Yoda toddles over and force heals him. And as I said, this is, you know, as of this recording, we have not seen this in any Star Wars property. What do you make of the Mandalorian getting to debut this, like, new force power that we've never seen before in a Star Wars?
What do I make of it? Like, why?
I don't know. Just sort of like... it seems like a big thing. Like, here's my less inside the fandom experience of The Last Jedi. People freak out when new force powers are introduced.
Yeah.
And so this is just sort of like done in this Disney Plus series. I mean, I guess to me, I'll just say, to me, it signals like, how important these Disney Plus series will be for canon. You know what I mean? Like, I think you can skate by not watching the animated series and still feel like you're bopping along in the universe. But I think they're really going to, you just like the way that Marvel's going to make their Disney Plus shows interconnect with their movies. I think this is really going to like, you're really going to need to watch these Disney Plus shows to really be in the ongoing narrative of Star Wars. You know,
well, I also think what we're seeing with the development of things like force healing and expansion of what it means to be a Jedi and to be force sensitive, goes back to something that the creative forces behind Lucasfilm have been trying to do for the last several years, which is recognize that if the force as a storytelling device is going to endure year to year into the future, it has to be about more than fighting in a cool way. You know, much as many martial arts disciplines are not just about fighting. They're about centering. It's about focus. It's about discipline, and kind of asceticism. And I think it's a recognition that the force can't just be about leaping and hurling rocks or ripping down an air conditioner and throwing it at your opponent or twirling your lightsaber through the air or zapping them with lightning. Like, the force has to be about more than violence. And this, you know, Luke said as much in The Last Jedi and demonstrates it by not using force powers to confront Kylo Ren and defeat him in battle, but using force powers to project an image of himself that inspires people throughout the galaxy and halts the First Order in its tracks and distracts. Like, that force projection was also a new force power.
Right. Right.
And again, we will not get into that too much here, but the idea of what the force can do in terms of the transference of energy and connection is another new force power that we're seeing. And force healing is kind of like, okay, like that's a traditional superpower, you know? You know, if you, it's in a way Wolverine has it, you know, and video games have always had, you know, you eat this heart and you will be healed, you know, and your energy levels will go back up. And so force healing, healing is not a new power, but in Star Wars it is. And I think it shows the expansion of what the force can do beyond just battle. And that, I think, is super important.
Yeah. The only thing that I will say about it is that, it is a potentially, I hate using this phrase because it's like such a, you know, dig your feet in fanboy thing to say, but it is a potentially promise breaking force power, right? Because it's like, it's just going to be tricky introducing it. Cause if like, who can force heal? Can anyone force heal? Like, if anyone could force heal, why would anyone ever die in a battle? You know, sort of thing. So just something to.
Well, Joanna, we can't, but there are consequences to force healing.
Sure. Oh no, maybe it's draining or whatever. I'm just saying like that's the thing that they have to be careful about with something like force healing.
Here's what I like
about
more
so than like astral projection or something like that, which is like in a fight situation, the stake, you know, like if the Mandalorian gets majorly hurt, you know, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but like let's say the Mandalorian gets like mortally wounded. Then Baby Yoda is gonna have to not be there for that, because if Baby Yoda's there, then Baby Yoda would heal the Mandalorian. You know, there's just questions around it. I'm not opposed to it. I'm just saying.
No,
there are
but
questions
I,
around it.
We're a little hamstrung because, we know more than we can discuss. But I think I'll say this. So let's just go off of The Last Jedi. Is that the and the Mandalorian? Because when Baby Yoda uses the Force, what happens to Baby Yoda? He kind of goes into hibernation. Even in this, when he heals Greef Karga, like, he collapses afterward. And that's just, it's not like he grew a new arm for Greef Karga. You know, he just like healed a tear in his skin. So it wasn't necessarily, I mean, do you think Greef was mortally wounded? Was he dying?
They said the poison. Yeah, they said the poison was spreading. Like, I think he was mortally wounded.
Yeah. So that's a big save. And, and obviously makes a big impact on Greef. But I think, the force is not an endless resource. So that if you project yourself across the galaxy, it takes so much out of you that your life force evaporates. Like, you are spending your coins, you know, you are using your power and depleting yourself. And so I think that's what preserves it as, like, it's not just endless force healing. You get a force heal, and you get a force heal. Look under your chair. Everybody gets a force heal. Like, it's
right. But then I think that if you're going to do that, you need to make those. So I think I would have preferred it if, like, does the child sleep for the rest of the episode like he did last time when he used the force in a big way? Okay. Yeah. Like, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. You just need to, like, be able to show us the limitations of this thing. Okay. He can force heal, but it really takes it out of him, and he can't be doing it for everyone all the time. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. Well, you know, there's so many super, it's like we talk about this with Marvel, like, you know, a character like Scarlet Witch, Wanda, right, can, like, implant, have you see whatever she wants you to see. And it's such a huge power that you're like, how do we even have this character in this fight who can do this huge thing? And the answer is you often have to have Wanda sidelined because you can't actually have her in the fight because she's too powerful. So that's all I'm saying. All right, so I think we're close to wrapping it up. The last thing I think I want to say about this is things look dire for our heroes. We don't know how they're going to get out of this scrape. Is there anything that you want to see in the finale?
Well, my favorite line after the "Let's enjoy a libation to celebrate the close of our shared narrative" is, like, the favorite line is when Cara Dune looks at the Mandalorian and she's like, "Who's this guy?" Moff Gideon shows up and there's this tremendous pageantry and he's flanked by these death troopers and his collapsing wings of his TIE fighter curtsy to the ground of Navarro, and then he gets out and to the swells of majestic music with his cape flowing, and she's like, "Do I know you? Like, where are you? Who's this guy? What's he gonna do?" And I kind of love that they're just like, and I guess we have a new villain. There's a new kid in town.
New guy in town. Yeah. And there should always be, like, a little bit of humor in Star Wars to undercut the, like, the crazy high stakes that we're dealing with. But it's high stakes. The baby's in peril.
Gets scooped up like a volleyball at the end. They skid. The guy doesn't even slow down his speeder. He just, like, zooms right by and snatches him up by the little swaddle.
Yeah. The only other thing I want to say is that Gina Carano told us that her very first day on The Mandalorian, she was on that blurg. So that's just to give you a sense of sort of the, like, out of order way in which, you know, TV is filmed sometimes, especially TV that involves, like, such, you know, hot, like, production wise, like, it probably, if you're going to use blurgs, you might want to film, like, all your blurg stuff together or whatever. you know what I mean? Like, the blurg stuff at the beginning of the season and the blurg stuff at the end of the season or stuff like that. So, we know that Gina Carano's first thing she did was write a blurg. So, that was in this episode. So that's just an interesting thing to know. And like, the ongoing question mark of, like, when is Pedro Pascal actually in there in that suit? And I think what's true is that, Gina told us she worked with Pedro. So, like, we know that Pedro is in some scenes with Gina. I would like to think it was some of these conversations that we had in this episode, like, on the way to Navarro. I thought they were good conversations. I'd like to think Pedro was under the mask for those. But I think what is true is that the later the scenes were filmed in production, the more Pedro was there because he was cast later. It's this whole thing. You know what I mean? So in terms of the, like, who's in the suit when, it's hard to know. But I think if I had to guess, I would say he's in more of this episode than we've seen in the past episodes.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of guesswork about this. And my feeling is the more action you're seeing the Mandalorian do, the less likely that's going to be Pedro Pascal, because we know from our own conversation with Emily Swallow on this show, that who plays the armorer, you could barely see when you're in the Mandalorian armor. And so whoever is running around doing that work is by necessity a stunt person, because you're not going to put an actor, your lead actor in that kind of danger, running through a, you know, a rice paddy and jumping into water or off a cliff. Like, it's just not going to happen. So the more you see the Mandalorian throwing down, the more likely it's going to be somebody else.
But I would, you know, but I would just, you know, and I have no, like, I'm not even that fussy about it. Like, you know, as everyone has brought up, James Earl Jones gave an incredible performance as Darth Vader without ever being in that suit once. So, like, it's, you know, it's not a deal breaker for me in any respect that Pedro Pascal is not in that suit that often. But I would like to think that in some of these scenes, like when he and Kara are having a chat or Queel are having a chat, that Pedro's in there. And I there's part of me that feels like you can feel that. This episode, I think, just lands deeper. Now, maybe he wasn't in the suit at all in this episode, and I just sound like a fool to people who worked on the show, but I just have a feeling, a forced tingle, that maybe he was there for some of this. So we'll see. All right. Anything else you want to mention before we call it a day?
I don't think this could possibly resolve in any way that satisfyingly answers questions that everybody has about the origin of Baby Yoda or what comes next or what's been going on this whole time. And so I think Mandalorian season two is our wait for that is going to be much like the wait between saga films where we're endlessly debating possibilities. I'm braced for that. I'm braced for the next episode to be action-packed and reveal a little bit of information and then reveal just enough that we have tons more questions, and then that's going to be it for a while.
Right. And that being said, they you know, have been already filming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're going to get it. I'm just saying, I think it's not going to be like, let's resolve this. It's not going to be like Fargo where this is the Baby Yoda season and it's all easily and carefully tied up in a bow. I think it's going to be like, it's going to be like a serial in the sense of this is the cliffhanger. And if you want to know more, you're going to have to tune in over the next couple years for season 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Tune in next time. All right. So like I said, you can hear the two of us talking about The Rise of Skywalker and whether or not it connects in any meaningful way to The Mandalorian on this week's episode of Little Golden Men that will be out on Thursday morning. So won't have a ton of The Rise of Skywalker spoilers, but we will be discussing the film and our takes on it, reenacting our experience at the after party. I will say, though, it seems appropriate to say it on this podcast. We got to go to the premiere. We were lucky enough to go to the premiere. We were also lucky enough to be seated like two rows behind the Mandalorian crew. So like Gina Carano, Pedro Pascal, Deb Chow, Anthony Breznican bulldozed, his own wife to get to say hi to Ming-Na Wen.
You're making me sound like a jerk.
No. It was really cute and funny. You were like, oh my God, she's here. And you got really excited.
There were lots of people around, but I was really excited for Ming-Na Wen because we're from the same town.
It was really, really cute. Emily Swallows. Yeah. So we were like, right. We were in the Mandalorian section, which was really fun for us. No, you weren't a jerk at all. You were just excited. It was really cute. And,
now I've got some apologizing to do.
No. You don't have to apologize. You maybe have not lived until you've seen Pedro Pascal wearing a silken, like, bathrobe as couture, to the Rise of Skywalker premiere. It was pretty, pretty incredible. If you haven't seen those photos. Okay. Until next time, Anthony, where can folks find you?
You can find me nowhere, man. I'm hiding out until the holidays are over. No, I'm on Twitter at Breznican, and of course, like you, on the pages of vanityfair.com.
We will have a lot of The Rise of Skywalker content coming in the next few days. So you really are going to want to bop over to Vanity Fair. And I will just preview really quickly. The good thing that I think is that we have very different takes on The Rise of Skywalker over at VF.com, which means you're just going to get whatever you feel about the movie. I think there will be content there to serve you from someone on our staff, which is fun. And, you know, how it should be. Yes, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And we will see you next time. And once again, we have to wait a week and a half for the next Mandalorian episode. It'll be out, I believe, on the 27th or 28th. And we will have an episode up then. I will be in London. But have microphone, we'll travel, and we'll see you after the holidays.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.